Why is certifying a new airplane so much harder than certifying a new pilot? I'm Paul Plank, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Millard. He's a CFI based in the Buffalo, New York area, operates a training school now based at the Lancaster Airport, also is the editor of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which you can find on the web. Bob, thanks for taking a few minutes out for our listeners today.
Well, as always, Paul, I enjoy doing this.
We like to start the week with a safety-related topic, and in your most recent edition of Over the Airwaves, you wrote about airplanes versus pilots and compared what the requirements are to get an airplane certified to go into the air versus what it takes a human being to be certified to be at the controls of that airplane, and noted quite a disparity.
There is a major disparity, and it's an interesting disparity. Airplanes, as we all know, take a long time to get certified. It takes a long time to have an A&P certified, the individuals that work on our airplanes. The standards are high. They're stringent, they're tough, and they're oftentimes expensive to endure. Pilots, on the other hand, our certification process requirements are admittedly quite a bit less challenging. And the reason for that is, well, for many reasons, I suppose, but we try to minimize the burden on pilots and new pilots necessary or the requirements necessary to qualify. The interesting parallel, though, is while the critics of increasing standards for pilots will quickly point out that by increasing the standards, we run the risk of reducing the pilot population. Interestingly, though, when we increase the standards for airplanes, there does not seem to be a corresponding reduction in airplane production or the number of models or makes of new airplanes coming online. In other words, higher standards do not necessarily translate to decreased participation. Now, if we look at it from the point of accidents and the man-machine relationship between the pilot and the airplane, the pilot and the airplane, the higher standards associated with airplanes, we see that there is a marked reduction in the cause of accidents. In other words, we know that approximately 80% of all aviation accidents are pilot-induced. We can say that between 10 and 15% of all aviation accidents are attributable to the airplane itself, some mechanical factor. So we have a higher standard for aircraft maintenance and production, and we have a marked decrease in the cause of accidents related to the airplane itself. So if we drew upon those data, we might say that if 80% of the accidents are pilot-induced, there would be good justification for additional standards and higher requirements, raising the bar, if you will.
Well, I'd have to point out, though, Bob, that there is some evidence that having less rigid standards for aircraft does result in more models coming out. I think the light sport aircraft movement recently has demonstrated that having to meet 8 ASTM standards and self-certify has resulted in something like 70 or 75 light sport aircraft models being available, whereas if those people had all had to go through Part 23 to get there, there probably obviously would not have been that many. And I think there's a parallel there, too, in the fact that it's cost-based. It's proving that, I mean, generally it's a $50 million proposition at minimum to get a new aircraft designed through Part 23. Obviously, it's nowhere near that expensive to get an LSA to market. So how would you answer people who say that, it just would be a cost that people would not be able to clear?
Well, clearly there is a balance. One is not, or I'm certainly not saying that we need to raise the standards for pilots up to, again, an onerous level where it's just prohibitive. But I think what we have to do is correlate standards that are being imposed with two factors. One is the safety factor. Will heightened standards improve safety? And number two, will heightened standards really in fact, be a burden to pilots, to new pilots? One could argue that the standards right now are too low from a safety perspective because we know that 80% of all fatal accidents are pilot-induced. And number two, we know that the lower standards are not, in fact, keeping pilots in the system. We're down to about almost a half, or at least two-thirds of the total pilot population that we had in the 1970s, despite the lower standards. So, you know, standards and participation oftentimes are not linked. Lower the standards does not necessarily mean that we're going to keep people in or out. The ultimate objective is to produce a safe pilot. And if we can produce a safe pilot without driving pilots out of the system, a safer pilot without driving pilots out of the system, I think the whole industry would be well served.
Well, and you would, I mean, a lot of people don't become pilots or don't step into small aircraft because of their safety record. And so I suppose if you had a safer industry, there are people who are staying out of it for reasons other than cost who might get into it.
Well, the reluctant spouse is classic in this particular case.
Right.
Cirrus is, just as an aside, I think they have a wonderful marketing tool, not only a safety tool, but a marketing tool in the ballistic chute. I've heard many cases where pilots said, you know, my wife said, go ahead as long as it has a parachute to protect us. You know, that speaks to the fact that the reluctant spouse is concerned about safety. And if we can do something to reduce this fatal accident rate, I think it's going to translate very positively into more pilots coming in. And the only way to reduce the safety, the accident rate, in my opinion, is to do something about the training standards.
All right. Now, aside from initial training standards, I think one of the things that you have written about in the past often is recurrent training and just staying current. Is that something we have to address too? I mean, I think a lot of people probably go through the model where they're excited, they have the money set aside, they go out and get their private certificate, and then they end up not flying very often. They don't own an aircraft, they don't get out and rent one often enough, and after a couple of years, they're really, really rusty. Is that as big a deal as the initial training?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, in fact, if the initial training is effective, then the new pilot is convinced beyond any reasonable doubt that of the need that they have to get out and fly more often and engage in constant recurrent training, at least on an annual basis as opposed to every 2 years, as we now have it. We have to also recognize the fact that we have a 20-80 rule working in the pilot community roughly. About 20% of us are, we really don't need any standards or reminders or calendars to tell us when we need to train. We train because we want to. We want to become better pilots. But unfortunately, that's just the 20%. The other 80%, in my opinion, are those that stay legally, minimally proficient and qualified. If all they need is a biennial flight review, that's all they're going to get. They're not going to do anything more or less than is required to maintain minimal legal status to fly. And it's those people that will only respond to a change in the standards. They're not going to respond to an FAA or AOPA safety course. They don't go. So the only way we can get to that population is to legislate a tighter standard.
We're talking with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, and we'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We're talking about pilot proficiency. For some reason, Bob, this topic seems to come up a lot when we get on the phone together. But I wanted to ask you about the notion that the practical test standards should be minimum standards. Are people training to budget rather than training to proficiency too often?
No question. Absolutely no question about it. The practical test standards have become the gold standard among many flight training institutions and flight instructors. I see it every time I go out and work with a student that says, you know, listen, I've got to get through the test, I've got to get through the written, I've got to get through the practical, and I'll be legal to go. That's like saying I have to get out of high school with a D average and hope to get into college or hope to become a success in life.
Mm-hmm.
The standard that we have in aviation, unfortunately, is being interpreted as that point of proficiency that we all need to obtain in order to remain safe. And I don't think the FAA and its original conception of the practical test standards had that in mind. I think truly, I think they said this is a benchmark for minimal acceptable performance. And what we need to do as pilots is to go well beyond the practical test standards. We need to do that as flight instructors and as flight schools and educate people in the science of flight rather than just getting them through a 65 question, a multiple choice questionnaire, and a few maneuvers in a flight test.
Well, now, how do you balance that with not getting overly stringent on people? Because for most people who are learning to fly, the investment in training is a substantial outlay. I mean, it's on the order of a third to a half of what the average new car costs. If you mandate higher standards, I mean, do you want to mandate higher standards, or how do we convince people to do that? Insurance discounts, is that the answer? How do we do this?
Well, I think the insurance industry certainly is the one that's going to play the largest role in this, because they are not persuaded by other forces in the aviation community, as is the FAA. The insurance industry says, you know, this is what we're going to charge and this is what we're going to require in order to fly specific airplanes. But I think more often than not, it's getting to the flight schools and the flight instructors and simply convincing them that it's in our best interest to prepare more proficient pilots. For example, here in Western New York in January is probably our worst month of the year. I had almost a record-breaking number of hours of actual flight instruction given, despite some horrendous weather conditions where we had to, you know, wait out the bad stuff and then find days or hours when it can get out and deal with hefty crosswind situations, iced over runways, dealing with low ceilings and poor visibility, and using our instrument capability to take primary students through and let them see just how fast a snow shower can cover an airport and what it can do to our forward visibility. This doesn't cost the student another nickel. In fact, the student, I believe, because they're training more frequently and they're not being delayed by such conditions, they're actually getting through their training more quickly at lower cost and are receiving better training as a result. Now, there are lots of reasons why this can't be done universally. One of the biggest reasons is because we're using yesterday's flight students as today's flight instructors. So many of the flight instructors simply have lacked the skills and experiences themselves to give this kind of more aggressive training. We need to instill, in my opinion, an attitude first with the flight training community that it is in the students, it's in our own best interest to have these students more proficient as they take to the skies. Let me just add one other thing. Mm-hmm. One of the most frequent disappointments to a flight school, and it happens far more often than we like to see, is a landing that goes wrong because a student found himself in the throes of a gusty situation or a balloon landing or a bounce landing that results in a non-injurious but ego-damaging bent propeller or broken nose gear, all because all of the training that student was given was during those very fair weather, calm wind days.
Mm-hmm.
If we could eliminate those accidents, again, our insurance costs would go down, more students would go on to complete their ratings, and the entire industry would be better served.
Well, Bob, I know that one of your reasons for opening Bob Miller Flight Training is to take these discussions out of a vacuum and prove them out in real life. And I look forward to keeping track of how things go, and we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can find Bob's work at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.